I think we're in a secular inflationary environment for a simple reason. The federal debt of the reserve currency issuer is not sustainable unless its real rates are sustained negative for some period of time.
Bitcoin, most of the indicators that I tracked point to being fairly mid-cycle in terms of the bull run. And so I still think the next 18 months look favorable for the asset. I would be surprised not to see six-figure Bitcoin over the next 18 months. Obviously, anything's possible, but I'm bullish on both gold and Bitcoin in that time frame.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Mantra, the security first, compliance focused L1, which is onboarding the next wave of financial institutions. You're going to be hearing all about them later in the show, but for now, Mantra, thanks for making this episode possible.
So I've got one final question for you here, and maybe some longer term stuff, and then I'd actually love to zoom in on this next year or like 6 to 12 months or something like that. I think one of the things it's sometimes hard to parse out as a listener here are, you know, when we're talking about these big themes, are we talking on a 5 to 10 year time horizon? Are we talking on a 6 to 12 month time horizon? And I'd love to get into some more of your tactical recommendations over the next 12 months. But before we do, you know, we've got I think one interesting element would here on the long term would be, do you guys see us being in a secular regime of inflation, or are we still in this sort of disinflationary regime that we've seen for the last 40 some odd years? And, you know, one thing that's been sort of interesting to watch is the price of oil, you know, has steadily crept back up. There was an article that I saw in Reuters about a month ago that there is a goal to refill the SPR, which is some 230 million barrels of oil by the end of the year, which I thought was a little bit underreported on if they're actually going to try to do that. But I would be curious to get both your takes on, you know, where do we go in terms of oil from here? How much is that playing into inflation? And, you know, are we going to ever get back to 2%? Or, you know, this has been historically sort of a heretical opinion, but are we going to settle more towards, you know, somewhere in the range of 3 or 4%, and the Fed is eventually going to adjust their target?
I think we're in a secular inflationary environment for a simple reason. The federal debt of the reserve currency issuer is not sustainable unless its real rates are sustained negative for some period of time. And that can kind of go back and forth, but that is what needs to happen. Again, barring some massive productivity miracle, that's like, I think a lot of all the other inputs to inflation are secondary or tertiary to that simple mathematical reality. I think that's the key to me.
So I think we're going to have higher highs and higher lows of inflation than we had in the prior decade. That's how I would describe a secular inflation. And, you know, kind of a major thing I've been pointing out is, so questions I got over the past couple years were, are they going to get inflation back down to 2%? And my answer has generally been, I don't know, but I don't think that's the right question. I think the right question is, what's going to happen with inflation the next time we have an upcycle in PMIs, for example, manufacturing purchasing managers index? Because I think that's the real test. You can get inflation down temporarily if you're willing to have a recession, if you're willing to disinflate enough. And that's kind of the pseudo cycle we've been on. It's obviously been offset by fiscal, as we've been talking about. So they've not gotten it down to 2%, but they have muted it significantly. We're starting to see early signs of PMI reacceleration, you know, kind of rotation and what sectors are doing well. And so I think the big test is, if we get an upcycle in PMI, what does inflation do? My expectation is that inflation goes up or stays sticky when we get that next PMI rise. And so it's not a matter of, you know, could they touch 2% sometime this decade? Sure. You know, but the question is, can you sustain there and having like another cycle of growth while still sustaining there? And I think that's the much harder thing. And so, because I think this is going to be a more energy intensive cycle, I think we're going to be more linked to what happens with energy than we have been in say the prior 10 years or so. And so I think my expectations, higher highs and higher lows compared to what we had in say the 2010s decade.
Hmm. And so what are both of your thoughts on where, let's say, the price of crude oil goes from here? I think today we're sitting around just under $90, something in that region. And there was a period of time back in 2022 when it looked like energy was really taking off. Then you could speculate on whether or not this was political. It sort of looks like it was. The U.S. started to sell off the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Prices went down and sort of stayed there, and it moved out of the public limelight. But it's really started to rebound pretty dramatically. And I guess my question, especially if they're building back the SPR up, do you think it takes off from here, stays flat? Like, what do you think on maybe like a 6 to 12 month time horizon? Like, what's going to happen with energy?
Well, last week they came out and said they've stopped trying to refill it, which is,
oh, really? I missed that.
Trading, okay. Trading is hard. Short squeezes are hard. Dumping it when you have the supply is pretty easy, especially into a war, but buying it back is a little trickier, especially if the war is still going on. My view on oil has been, and over the last, call it, I don't know, 4 to 6 months, maybe, and it still is for the moment, at least, is oil's range bound. Like, you know, below 70, U.S. shale starts to roll off, or starts to have, you know, below 70, you start to get below U.S. shale break even points. And that doesn't mean you're going to immediately shut down shale, but like the world of 2014, 15, or the world of COVID, you know, barring some sort of new pandemic shutdown, where oil goes to, you know, 25, like it did in early 15, like that is not sustainable for shale. And I think critically on the downside, we saw like U.S. shale production just finally returned and surpassed 2019 peaks like late last year. So it took us 4 years to get back after that shutdown. It took like a year and a half, 2 years in the 14-15 down cycle to get back to prior highs. My point here is that if you get oil low enough for long enough, and I think that's below 70, maybe it's 60, maybe it's 50, but I definitely think it's below 50, you start shutting down U.S. shale production and taking it offline, you are effectively ceding the global oil market to Russia and Saudi Arabia for the next 2 to 4 years. And so I think geopolitically, there is no interest in the United States in doing that. So I think 70 is like floor. The flip side, as we saw last fall, is once oil gets to 85, 90, the treasury market starts to have problems. And once again, you know, oil gets to 85 and the 10-year takes off like scalded cat last week. So, you know, you're starting to see inflation break evens pick up. The correlation between oil prices and inflation break evens are actually pretty good. So I think the U.S., and right on course last week, the Biden administration comes out and goes, well, we're not going to buy back all that oil as soon as oil gets over 85, right? So I think oil will be range bound $70 to $90. The challenge is we've already sort of shot our shot in terms of running down the SPR and managing that. We've talked about why slowing down the economy is not good. China, you know, Chinese demand appears to actually be pretty good, despite all sort of commentary about, you know, what the weakness in commercial real estate there might mean for the broader economy. And so I think we'll be 70 to 90. I have had raised to me the view that, look, neither Putin nor MBS want Biden reelected, and both are acutely aware that higher oil will help that happen. And so maybe you see something geopolitically. That, to me, is the wild card where you could see oil higher. But failing that, I think we'll continue to be range-bound sort of 70 to 90 on oil.
That's generally how I view it. I think the upside breakout risk is higher than the downside breakout risk. And one reason I've liked to play the space by owning, say, oil producing equities and other energy related equities is that they've already been priced so that this oil level is good for a lot of them. Their valuations, their balance sheets, their profitability works pretty well at current prices. And so rather than have a view kind of in the near term of what happens with oil prices, I've been preferring to focus on those equities. My expectation is that this is kind of the new range, but that in some point in the years ahead, I do think we'll break out of this range. That's something I'm less confident on the timing on than, say, fiscal dominance. But I do think that eventually we break out of this range. But in the meantime, I think we're range bound, and that's basically a disinflationary offset that doesn't exist anymore. So from 2015 to 2020, the rise of shale oil very much disrupted global energy markets because supply came online faster than demand, and a lot of that supply was unprofitable. So even the ones bringing it to market weren't really making money from it. At least their investors weren't. And so as we kind of go forward, I do think that that glut is behind us now. That doesn't mean that U.S. shale oil is going to necessarily go down quickly or, you know, even go down at all. But I think the delta, the rate of change over, say, a five-year period is not going to be as significant as it was back then. And I think the global market now has this shale built into it. And so I think there's fewer positive surprises to the upside in terms of supply. Over the past year and a half, China's demand has been kind of consolidating for a while because they were, you know, they're going through that commercial real estate deleveraging. They had a lot of weak domestic indicators, even though their output was still good in terms of exports and things like that. There were early signs that they might be bottoming. They might be stabilizing and kind of going back up in terms of domestic consumption. And so it's not just the U.S. and the SPR that has held down oil. It's also you know, China is also one of the biggest consumers. What's happening there? And I think that their politics have gotten to the point where supporting the equity market, supporting the real estate market, are probably starting to take a higher precedent than they were 12 months ago. And so my expectation is that both the U.S. and China probably are going to be relatively constructive for demand for energy over the next 12 months. But I don't necessarily expect fireworks, but it's just that's not something I try necessarily predict other than I would be a buyer of dips and I'm structurally pretty bullish on the energy space.
Hmm. Let's do the same thing for, maybe we can, this can be sort of our mini lightning round here where I just ask you about a whole bunch of different assets on a 6 to 12 month time horizon. But what do you think about the dollar, which has been relatively also range bound here for the last couple of years in between the kind of 100 to 108 sort of level? I know, Luke, you've talked about the dollar being lower as an important lever for injecting liquidity into the system. Where do you guys see the dollar moving in the next, on like a 12 month time horizon?
Lower in a orderly manner.
My view would be sideways to down. So I don't significantly disagree with that. It'd be another fairly low conviction. I have pretty high conviction that the high we saw in recent years is probably the high watermark we're going to see for a very long time. A challenging thing is that the dollar index is so tied to the euro that, you know, that particular currency pair weighs very, very heavily. So I have more interest on a currency by currency basis. Like I think some of the Latin American currencies are, you know, less weak than people are maybe accustomed to at the current time. So I think that the worst the dollar move is probably behind us, which should be somewhat beneficial for all these entities that have these dollar-based debts that are, you know, maybe not in the most dire straits, but that are kind of teetering. I think a lot of them have gotten through the worst of it.
Hey everyone, this episode is brought to you by Mantra, the security first, compliance focused L1, which is onboarding the next wave of financial institutions into Web3. So you guys have heard me talk about Larry Fink talking about tokenization. You've seen the clips on CNBC. You know that Larry and BlackRock are very, very excited about this idea. And the reason for that is they're looking at these trillions of dollars of off-chain real world assets. They want to digitize those and bring them on-chain, which is going to be a massive opportunity. But in order to do that, they need a compliant L1, and that's where Mantra comes in. Mantra's been steadily climbing the ranks and now stands among the top four RWA projects on CoinGecko, which is representative of its rapid growth and influence in the tokenization space. Mantra's built using the Cosmos SDK, so they have some very cool stuff out of the box. They've got IBC interoperability. They also leverage CosmWasm smart contracts. Very cool design from an architectural standpoint. The next phase on the blockchain's testnet is Hongbai, so that's launching soon. So if you're a dApp developer or something like that, there's a lot of very cool opportunities for you. And I highly recommend that you click the link at the bottom of the show notes. I don't know that I sent you. Thanks very much again, Mantra, for making this possible. And again, guys, click the link at the bottom of the show notes.
And maybe we can bucket these two together, but we just talked about gold breaking out to new all-time highs. Bitcoin, as of today, sits at around, I think, just under 72,000, which is, you know, very near its recent all-time high. How do you guys view gold and Bitcoin on a 12-month time horizon?
A lot higher. Bull.
My view as well. I think as long as... So we've been in like a consolidating liquidity range for quite a while. My expectation is that over, call it 18 months, we break out of that. you know, watching this kind of gold consolidation kind of it kept banging its head around the all-time highs of like, you know, 2000 and change. You know, my view was, I don't know when it's going to break out, but once it breaks out, I think it's going to have legs to it. I think we're in the middle of that move now. And I think it's, you know, it's one of those things you don't want to overthink it. Like, it can get near-term overbought and people are going to be like, you know, it's going to correct. And, you know, it absolutely might, but it's like, it's been, you know, it's been in a bear market since like 2011. It's been in a consolidation for 3 years. So, you know, I do expect a pretty significant run here. For Bitcoin, most of the indicators that I tracked point to being fairly mid-cycle in terms of the bull run. And so, I still think the next 18 months look favorable for the asset. Again, it tracks global liquidity pretty well. You know, the on-chain indicators can, you know, show us, for example, how much long-term holders are selling into the current strength. Because even though obviously Bitcoin supply is constrained, if the price goes up, you know, 3x or 5x in a fairly short period of time, you generally see some of those older coins start to come to market and start meeting that new demand. And we've seen some of that, but so far we've seen less of that in this cycle than in prior cycles. And so I still think my expectation is there's room to run, both from the liquidity side being fairly constructive, so that should help demand. And I still think that there has to be a higher price to unlock some of these older coins to meet that demand. And so I would be surprised not to see six-figure Bitcoin over the next 18 months. Obviously, anything's possible, but I'm bullish on both gold and Bitcoin in that time frame.
Yeah. So maybe to just dive one layer deeper here, I'd be curious for the two of you. Do you see, you know, Bitcoin and gold as being expressions of the same trade? I heard Stanley Druckenmiller gave a pretty interesting framework in terms of how to think about gold versus Bitcoin, where, you know, one environment where maybe currency debasement is sort of the core underlying driver for both, but in a high growth environment, maybe you prefer Bitcoin as sort of this fastest horse, and in a stagflationary environment, maybe you'd rather hold gold where growth is a little bit more challenging. So Lynn, you just kind of gave us our level here. I'd be curious maybe if I could poke at you to say a little bit more than higher here. Like, what are we expecting here in terms of orders of magnitude? Because this is around the time, right? That's my read as well, Lynn, that we're maybe, you know, in inning five or something, or five or six maybe of this cycle. And this is around the time where the increased calls for 500K Bitcoin sort of come, and annoying skeptical me is kind of like, I don't know about that. That was a little rich for the next 18 months. So I would just love to get your sort of sense of magnitude here about where we end up.
You know, I think some of it depends, you know, how high depends on how acute things get on the fiscal side. Mm. And then there's a geopolitical overlay that you have to think about. I think I am very fascinated by gold re-becoming an oil currency. Like, I think a lot of the frameworks I see on gold focus strictly on real rates. Still, now we started the show showing that gold and real rates have broken decisively, completely, and for going on 2 years. And yet most people talking about gold only talk about real rates. There's another, and there's always been another component to gold. It's oil. It's energy. And so to me, and this goes for Bitcoin too, we are in this very unique period of time where, again, the reserve currency issuer has a fiscal problem. They need negative real rates. You cannot store your surpluses in their debt and not expect to lose money relative to oil, right? So we have this problem of peak cheap oil, where we need higher and higher oil prices to make sure that we continue to bring on enough oil supplies to offset the depletion rate in shale, which is estimated still somewhere 20-30% annually. And which Saudi Aramco just said, or the Saudi oil minister said at the end of December, was 7% globally, right? So if the Saudi Aramco guys were right, you need 7 million barrels a day and change more new online every year just to stay flat. And you're only going to do that given what's going on with the geology of it with higher prices. Okay, so oil prices have to go higher to keep energy supplies at a level where economic growth can continue to pay the interest on the debt and prevent the whole debt edifice from falling. At the same time, debt continues to rise, accelerated pressure by the interest rate hikes at the Fed and elsewhere around the world, and the secularly inflationary impacts we talked about before. And so as debt rises and rates rise and secularly inflationary impulses rise, the amount of the price of oil that the world can afford before blowing up the debt is coming down. Right. We know at 5% real rates, or 5%, 10-year rates in the U.S., things start to get really weird. The treasury market starts to dysfunction, that they have to come in, inject all the liquidity. So you've got, the world has been in this, I'm going to try to scrape. So we've got the price of, it's backwards here. Anyway, you get the point. We're in a convergence.
I'm really enjoying these sort of balloon animal type descriptions that you're giving us here.
I feel like Madonna in Vogue in 1990. You've got this reduced operating as we're going up, right? So as you're going along, the price of oil that the world can afford is coming down. The price of oil we need to keep growing oil supplies to support the debt keeps going up. And at some point, and I think we might already be past the point, what you'll start to see is the world say, okay, the only way this makes sense is if we keep oil range bound at whatever range works, slowly, but then we let the release valve be gold. The price of gold. So the price of gold relative to oil goes up. Now that's interesting because the price of gold relative to oil has nearly quadrupled since 2008, since Putin began basically buying lots of gold. The oil market globally is 12 to 15 times the size of the global gold market in annual physical production dollar terms. So you should start to see as this problem of we can't afford oil price X, we need oil price Y to find more oil gets more acute, you should start to see more and more nations reserve gold instead of bonds, which has been happening, which should continue to drive gold up relative to oil secularly. I think that is a secular driver of gold that like three people are talking about right now. And I think by the time this cycle is done, gold will have a different number in front of it. It may have an additional zero on the back of it, and everyone will be talking about it. And I think Bitcoin is as the proof of work, as the expenditure of energy, which is still by most observers called a waste and why Bitcoin will fail and it's anti-environmental. I think all those people saying those things will be on the other side saying it's not a flaw. It's a feature. Bitcoin is a neutral reserve asset with an energy link. More volatility than gold, more upside than gold to what I just described over time. Do I think it's going to happen the next 18 months? I don't. Could it? Sure. But like, I don't care. I'm unlevered. And I think that's important to highlight to people. Like, you need to stay unlevered because like these cycles are going to be volatile. But I think that energy linked to gold and Bitcoin is still so, so underappreciated in the context of the combination of peak cheap energy and in particular peak cheap oil. And the debt load, which already can't afford energy prices here, and that's only going to get worse as debt goes up and rates go up.
Hmm. Just one note on that. So the energy currency link is super critical. I would be curious why we haven't seen these AI energy linking demonizing type articles. These H100s are running on something, presumably. And that's
they're going to be running on nuke power, right? I mean, you've seen Microsoft come out and talk about buying a new nuclear power plant. Amazon just did spend, I think, $600 million to buy a nuclear power plant. Like,
really? No, I missed that.
All of a sudden, like, nuclear, that went right away. Like, the Overton window shifted really fast. Ignore nuclear is good now. And I've always thought it's good, but amongst the nuclear's bad crowd, nuclear suddenly good.
Oh, that's good. I think that's a positive. That would be
absolutely great. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Last question for the two of you here. Maybe we could just talk about bonds here and where you see let's say the 10-year and the 2-year ending this year. I'd be very curious because one thing that I think going into this year, there were something like 6, maybe 7 rate cuts that were priced into markets. I think at the time of recording, there are 3. And I actually saw guys like Larry McDonald calling for maybe rate hikes, actually, is what is needed here. And so I would just love to get a sense of, you know, just this age old sort of perennial questions about, are we getting rate cuts, rate hikes? How many, if so, and where do yields on sort of the 10 and 2 year end, maybe towards the end of this year?
I think the funny thing is that because we're, you know, kind of largely in fiscal dominance now, I think that the emphasis on the Fed is in many cases like backward looking, that the Fed has been a bigger source for markets for a long time. But as we kind of enter this fiscal dominant environment, I'm increasingly less interested in what the Fed does around the basis point margin. And more interested in what's happening with the treasury market, more interested in what's happening with the size of fiscal deficits, and those kind of more structural things. So to the extent that the Fed, you know, cuts rates a little bit, or if they even add some interest rate hikes to it, it's not really the answer, in my view. I think basically the large structural fiscal deficits are a bigger factor. And ironically, if they try to get down inflation by increasing interest rates, they're going to blow out the fiscal deficit even more. And so that's the lever that's different from the 70s, but closer to the 40s. And so for me, it's looking at, you know, what are tax receipts going to be like? So for example, now, because 2023 assets were pretty good, asset prices, we should expect decent tax receipts here, which ironically could narrow the deficit a little bit, which could give us, you know, kind of a somewhat weaker performance in 2024 for at least some of these, like, say, mega cap assets. I think those factors matter more. I think also we've seen, for example, some of the Treasury decisions to shorten the average duration of their treasuries have had bigger effects on the market than what the Fed does in a given meeting. So some of these quarterly treasury releases have been bigger factors than the Fed. Obviously, during kind of acute liquidity things, like, for example, the early 2023 banking issue, that was both a treasury and Fed issue together. But in general, I think that overall liquidity, overall fiscal is actually a bigger force than the Fed. So I don't really have a firm view, let's say a minus 3 cuts or plus a couple hikes. That range is largely irrelevant for my investment decisions. Obviously, if we were to get major moves outside of that range, I would start to care again. But as long as expectations are fairly somewhere in the middle, I think that's not the biggest lever to be focused on compared to what's happening in fiscal, compared to what's happening in, say, supply and demand of oil. Those, I think, are the bigger forces.
I agree with everything Lynn just said, and I would just add briefly, you know, one of my best relationships on the street has called bonds a blood sport now. Like it's if you want to jump in the ring and get bloodied up and kind of, you know, like exert a lot of effort for not a lot of progress, like knock yourself out. There's a lot of ways that can sort of, you know, we know from the fall, if the 10-year goes to 5%, it creates problems. And those problems in terms of treasury dysfunction aren't going to be allowed. Liquidity is supplied. Okay, so kind of there we go. On the downside, like, they could cut. Yes, I think they probably have to cut because of the fiscal situation. And they're still not, I think that is still a minority view that that's why they're going to do it. I don't think that's been internalized amongst a number of market participants. And then if you go to things like the SLR exemption, you know, if ISTA gets their permanent exemption on treasuries for the SLR, well, now you're talking about a de facto 0% funding rate for the U.S. banking system to buy treasuries that are yielding between 5 3/8 at the short end or whatever they are, and 4 1/4 or 4.4% at the long end. And so, you know, how many treasuries, if I'm a bank, would I buy if I could fund at zero and buy 4.2%? Probably a lot, right? And so that probably can keep, if that is allowed, which I suspect eventually it will be, that could get yields to go down, right? So could you make money on bonds? Sure. Like, but I think the key is on a real basis, you know, if/when that happens, like, Bitcoin, gold, stocks, particularly more industrial stocks, but I think stocks broadly are going to be orders of magnitude higher, right? So, I mean, if you look across, to me, if you look across a set of charts of S&P 500 over TLT, long bond, you can see, boom, it's like up and to the right over the last 2 years. Pave over TLT, an industrial infrastructure, same chart. Gold over TLT, same chart. Bitcoin over TLT is a little more volatile, but kind of same chart more recently. S&P Industrials over TLT. Like, it's, to me, the big trade is, on a real basis, the only way the U.S. government's debt, which again, I pick on, they are the reserve currency issuer. The only way that debt is sustainable on a nominal basis is if real rates are kept negative for a very, either very negative for a brief period of time, very negative, or quite negative for a sustained period of time. And that's what I think the message of those charts are. And that's why, you know, I think my friend's characterization of bonds as blood sport, like, great, yeah, you can make some money in bonds. 10-year could go, you know, they pass SLR exemptions and 10-year goes from 4.4 to 3.4. Great, you make some money, whatever. When they do that, gold's going up way more than bonds and stocks and Bitcoin, et cetera. So it's like, you know, for me, it's just, there's nothing, I don't have that strong a view on sort of where rates go. Because again, Lynn has made crystal clear, I agree with her, I don't know that it matters that much.
One thing I would add to that, if an investor's goal is to offset an equity portfolio, so whether you're an institution or a retail investor, obviously the 60-40 stock bond portfolio, the bonds are there mainly to smooth out volatility in the equity market, and that works fairly well in monetary dominance. But when you're in fiscal dominance, generally other asset classes tend to be better at offsetting the equity. So, for example, you can kind of imagine two directional risks you're worried about. One is obviously recession. That's where, for example, shorter duration treasuries could be helpful, kind of cash equivalents or up to the, maybe the 2 year or a little higher than that, kind of, you know, shorter end of the curve, basic protection against just kind of earnings disappointing and all these things like that. On the other hand, if you're worried about inflation reemerging, yields going up, then owning things like energy stocks, for example, or, you know, direct oil exposure, or gold or Bitcoin. These are the types of assets that I find more interesting to match with my equities in this environment, because the entire 60-40 portfolio is kind of designed around that structural disinflation, structural declining interest rates. And as we go to a new period, I think these other assets offset and kind of smooth out an equity portfolio better than just long duration bonds, which is, I think blood sport's a good, you know, phrasing for it. I call it the too hard pile. I put bonds in the too hard pile because if bond yields go up, there's other classes, asset classes that I think would be more affected. And if bond yields go down, as Luke said, I mean, I'd want to own things like gold and Bitcoin. I wouldn't want to own, you know, whatever move I could get in that long duration treasury yield. There's other assets that I'd probably want to own. And it also depends on what reason it was for those moves. And so I've just not been really using long duration bonds as a portfolio segment, even though I am acutely aware of things like recession risk or inflation risk. I find that other assets work better with the equities.
Hello, listeners of On the Margin. I've got good news for those of you who are in the crypto scene. Blockworks is bringing back Permissionless. We're going to be doing Permissionless 3. And this year we are heading west. So we're moving that out to Salt Lake City. That's going to be October 9th through 11th. This year, we've got a phenomenal lineup of speakers for you. So we've got Balaji headlining, we've got Sriram Munib, Matt Hogan of Bitwise, Jan Van Eck. This one's going to be a blast, guys. And I saw many of you out in London for DAS this year, and I hope to see you out in Salt Lake for Permissionless. And because y'all are such faithful listeners, we've got, if you use code MARGIN10, you're going to get 10% off your tickets. Appreciate you all. Hope to see you out there.
Actually, there was a great, so I tweeted out that I was interviewing you guys today, and there were, anyone had any questions, and there were a bunch of great ones, some of which we've covered, but here was just an interesting one, and maybe we can close on this because I know we're in our last couple minutes here. But if you had to say which comes first, inflation going back over 5% or a recession, which of those would you say we get first?
My guess would be inflation. The other way I've been putting it is I think recession or no recession is now more sector specific. When you have this big of a gap between fiscal and monetary, you can get sharply divergent sector performance. So, for example, commercial real estate's in a depression. Whereas, you know, other areas are in an expansion, right? And so I think that we could see a rotation, for example. We are starting to see some weakness in the labor market. You know, you're up from 3.4% unemployment to 3.8%. You know, around the margins, some of that's getting weaker, perhaps, even as we see reacceleration in some of the harder stuff like manufacturing PMIs. So I would have not super high conviction on that, because I think even if we do get a recession, it looks different when you're pre-stimulating by $1.6 trillion in deficits. I think you enter a type of recession that looks like a fiscally dominant recession. So my view is even somewhat divorced from the business cycle, even though I'm, you know, every 2 weeks I'm kind of trying to aggressively map out, you know, whether the economy is expanding or contracting. But I think that overall, there's when people ask about recession, they often think it's going to look like global financial crisis. It's going to look like COVID. It's going to be this big disinflationary recession. Whereas my expectation is it looks more like a 2001 recession, or it looks more like, you know, a 1970s recession. There's different magnitudes it can look like, but I think it looks more like those other types of recessions, even if you were to get one. But yeah, my answer would probably be I would expect higher inflation before recession, but not super high conviction.
And if I can add to that, that's a great point, Lynn. And you know, in terms of how things look different, you know, you have a recession. The last three recessions in the U.S., the deficit has risen by 600, 800, and 1,200 basis points of GDP, right? So we're running, call it 7 right now. The deficit in a recession goes to 13% of GDP, 15% of GDP. COVID at 12 is, I think, a bit of a one-off, but just for, you know, the math, 19% of GDP. So now let's take the COVID case off, since it was a pandemic. You just sort of a 01 to, you know, 08 type scenario, you're looking at 6 to 8% of GDP deficit added on top of all of this, 7%. So you're looking at 13 to 15% of GDP deficits at a time, you know, that probably pushes the dollar up. So foreigners are going to be selling treasuries to finance their current account, defend the currencies. Banks are going to be taking reserving losses, and they've been, you know, encouraged, regulated into buying treasuries as their loan loss reserves for the last 10 years. So they, in theory, would be selling at some point in that cycle. And you quickly go, okay, you could easily have net supplies of treasuries needed to be bought at 15 to 20% of GDP, which is a nearly World War II levels, which was highly inflationary. And in a world where we know they know, they're not going to let the treasury market dysfunction for long. So to me, I think there's a real possibility that even if we got a recession, treasury yields would go up and you would see what we see in emerging markets in a recession, which is the price of stuff goes up, right? Like I just saw an article 2 weeks ago. In Egypt, stocks are up 38% on the year in local. And they're down 13% in dollars. Okay, let's bring that to America. The S&P is whatever, it's up, I don't know, 10%, 4% in the year, I don't know. What is it in Bitcoin? Down. What is it in gold? Down. So I think very much it's important once you get into these fiscal situations, like just because we're the U.S., if we have a fiscal situation, a debt situation like an EM, maybe we get an outcome of like a similar where stocks go down in hard currencies, but they go up in the dollar.
Guys, you both have been just super, super generous with your time here. I know we've got to wind down. Maybe just to give both plug both of you a little bit. You know, Luke, I think you've been done such a good job. Listeners of Forest for the Trees will know drawing this connection in between the energy and currency markets. Like you were just light years ahead on that. And Lynn, you can go back to interviews and newsletters that you were putting out back in 2020 talking about the shift from monetary to fiscal dominance. And you also just released the book, your first book, Broken Money, which is phenomenal. So guys, obviously, I'm sure most of you will know Lynn and Luke at this point. You should follow them, subscribe to their work, all that stuff. But Lynn and Luke, what is the best way for listeners who aren't current subscribers already or who aren't following you? What's the best way to get more information on the information that you put out?
So people can check out lynnalden.com. That's where I post most of my research. And also they can check out Broken Money on Amazon or elsewhere. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, I'm at fftt-llc.com and at Luke Grohman on Twitter, or X. Sorry.
guys, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on. We'll have to do it again soon.